This is VOA's International Edition. A long-awaited U.S. interest rate hike takes hold. New moves for peace in the Syrian civil war. Holiday stress could be more dangerous than you think.
Chronic stress can produce wear and tear on the body and wear and tear on the brain and lead to long-term health consequences.
Joy comes to the theater. The movies, that is. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. central bank policymakers have implemented a modest interest rate hike for the first time in 9 years. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen said policymakers decided to increase the rate as the U.S. economy expands at a moderate pace. Some analysts say it could be the first of several additional hikes by the Federal Reserve, also known as the Fed, in the coming year. The decision immediately increases borrowing costs for American businesses and consumers and could ripple through the world economy. International Business Times financial correspondent Owen Davis spoke with my colleague Jim Stevenson to explain the timing of the move and what it means.
The markets have been expecting the Fed to raise interest rates for at least a year now, and there's been a lot of anticipation around this. The Fed saw a lot of positive economic indicators in the last month or two. Labor markets are improving steadily. The one thing that's not quite there is inflation, but what the Fed wants to do and what Fed Chair Janet Yellen explained today is to start moving interest rates up ever so slightly so that if inflation does come around and the economy does start to heat up and get out of control, the Fed will have some room to maneuver, and it won't have to raise interest rates suddenly and shock the markets.
And that gives them a little bit of ability to help control tougher times should they come back.
Right. And the Fed has been cagey about whether or not they're precisely thinking about that factor. But with interest rates benchmarked close to zero, there's not much room to maneuver.
As I was watching the U.S. markets, they're up about 1% as we're speaking. And it seems that the markets have expected this and built this in.
Right. At this Fed meeting, there were the highest expectations going into it from the market that the Fed would lift interest rates for the first time in 9 years. The Fed has been telegraphing this decision for the last month or two. Janet Yellen called it a live option in congressional testimony a couple weeks ago. So the markets were pretty well prepared for this. It would have really been a shock had they not raised interest rates this time around.
Now, they raised it by 25 basis points. For the average Joe out there, what does that mean?
That's 0.25%. So, you know, if you're looking at credit card rates that are 15%, 16%, something like that, this little 0.25%, 0.25% is not going to look like a whole lot. And it's not going to trickle into the economy, and at least in terms of your average borrower is not going to see huge cost increases on debt anytime too soon. Mortgages won't change terribly much, at least in the short term, because they're based on treasuries. Treasury bonds already have this priced in. These expectations have gone back months.
I know foreign markets look very closely at what happens in the U.S. economy because it is the largest in the world. How will they react to an increase in interest rates?
Well, again, a lot of this has been anticipated. You've seen some moves in currencies that have seen this coming. But what this is going to do is make the dollar look even more attractive to foreign markets. You're going to see more capital pour into the dollar. The dollar has already been strengthening over the past several months. So this is going to continue a trend of a more expensive dollar. It's going to weigh on U.S. imports. It's going to exacerbate some of these emerging market challenges in attracting capital that have started to emerge in the last year.
Owen Davis is a finance writer for International Business Times. You can find all of his great work online. Owen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Some economists have argued it is too early to raise the rate both domestically and internationally, given the sluggish state of some major economies. The central bank's interest rate hike is getting a lot of reaction in social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to talk about it. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
Let's start off with what the Fed is saying all about this on Twitter.
Sure. The central bank is on Twitter at Federal Reserve, and the account has been really active Wednesday, as you can imagine. is shared a link to the streaming of the Fed chairwoman Janet Yellen's opening statement and her transcript. Neither Yellen nor Fed vice chairman Stanley Fischer are on Twitter. So getting into why the Fed is in the headlines, as we just heard from Davis, the bank raised interest rates for the first time since the financial crisis. And although raising it by 0.25 percentage points is really just a symbolic move, many people are fretting over it.
I'm sure that makes for a quite interesting segment.
Mm-hmm.
What all are they saying?
Let's start with Dan Alpert, who is a managing partner of a New York investment bank. He sent out a number of tweets on the decision, but the latest one reads like this. Almost 100% of their, meaning FOMC, analysis is domestic factors. They are stuck in a pre-globalization mindset and ignoring all else. His handle is at Daniel Alpert. Reuters Insider tweeted this. Are there enough economy geeks out there to get some kind of hashtag Fed or hashtag FOMC to trend? And judging by the number of tweets using those hashtags, the answer is no. The thing is, interest rates are a bit more complicated to talk about than, let's say, the Kardashians. Here's one comment under a New York Times article. A reader in New Jersey wrote, "Economically, this move makes no sense whatsoever. Period. Politically, the Fed is no choice." That opinion is resonating with a lot of Democrats, many of whom believe higher interest rates would hurt the job market and the working class. Ray?
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at GABBYLEY. That's GABBYLEY. You can also tell us what you think on our program's account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. The way is now clear for the International Syria Support Group to meet at the United Nations in New York Friday, following agreement in Moscow between the United States and Russia in meetings Tuesday between Secretary of State John Kerry, Russia's President Vladimir Putin, and his Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. This third round of talks could result in a draft Security Council resolution on a Syrian transition process aimed at ending 5 years of war. Differences remain, however, between Washington and Moscow over the fate of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who is a Russian ally, and about which opposition groups to allow to participate in the transition process. David Lesh, a Syrian analyst at Trinity University in Texas, told International Edition's Victor Beatty that Mr. Kerry's remarks reflect an evolution in U.S.-Syria policy, which now recognizes Mr. Assad cannot be removed short of a major military intervention involving American forces.
They've come to realize in the interim over the last few years, especially with Iran and Russia emphatically wanting to keep Bashar al-Assad in power, that they can't do anything short of boots on the ground to remove Bashar al-Assad. So I think the administration has reluctantly come to accept that Bashar al-Assad will stay in power for some amount of time during some sort of transition process as preordained by the 2012 Geneva Communique, which is still the popular framework for political resolution to the Syrian conflict.
What does it all mean for this pending Friday meeting of the International Syria Support Group in New York?
It means that there's a lot of negotiating to happen. I think all parties recognize that there must be a negotiated settlement to end the war or de-escalate the war before concentrating on the bigger threat that certainly the regional international parties and certainly the United States feel in terms of the Islamic State. The decision that they have made is that in order to have a negotiated settlement of any sort, they have to put off the disposition of the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, till a later date. Therefore, that will not be an obstacle to even engaging in negotiations that may lead to a political settlement. Now all parties are aboard on that. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, of course, have been committed to removing Assad before rather than during or after a transition process. Many of the Syrian opposition parties are adamantly opposed to Bashar al-Assad continuing in power for any length of time. So this is something that has to be negotiated.
Well, Mr. Kerry did say of the Syrian opposition's position that the fact that Mr. Assad must leave as soon as peace talks begin is a non-starting position.
Because the government of Bashar al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad himself will not engage in a process of negotiation that puts him out of business. They see themselves continuing the long term. There has to be some sort of formula whereby the government of Syria and Bashar al-Assad believes that they have enough authority to continue on. At the same time, that a critical mass of the Syrian opposition believes that they've been empowered in terms of municipal or provincial autonomy. Whether or not both sides can be compelled to find that exact formula that'll work for each side, that remains to be seen.
David Lesh, Syrian analyst at Trinity University in Texas. He was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. This year, China loosened its one-child policy, which for decades had prevented millions of families from expanding. Shannon Van Zandt reports from Hong Kong on how the fertility industry abroad is responding to the possibility of scores of Chinese interested in having more children.
At the end of October, China's government made a landmark decision to ease the country's one-child policy for the first time since it was implemented 35 years ago. All married couples in China are now allowed to have two children, and many in the fertility industry are predicting that China will become the world's top market for in vitro fertilization technologies. Luke Rombaltz is a professor and doctor with Australia's Monash IVF Group Limited.
So I can imagine that people who actually have conceived one child when they were in their mid-30s, many years ago, that they might now be in their 40s, and even though they would perhaps prefer to have a child on their own, they might find that that's no longer possible.
Couples face bureaucratic hurdles when trying to conceive through IVF clinics in China. The Chinese government forbids gender selection and advanced fertility procedures. Families also have to apply for birth licenses and provide proof of marriage before being treated. So increasingly, China's growing middle class is going abroad for fertility treatments to places like Australia, Thailand, and the United States. James Marshall manages business development at Superior ART, a fertility clinic in Thailand. He says the number of Chinese patients has nearly doubled over the last 3 years.
As a percentage of our total patients, I'd say it's risen from being about 3 years ago being maybe about 15% to now be about 35% of our total patients.
Clinics like Superior ART are changing their services to draw Chinese customers. Marshall says Superior ART has hired Mandarin-speaking staff, begun publishing clinic brochures in Mandarin, and sought affiliation with other hospitals and fertility clinics in China. In doing so, overseas hospitals may be filling a gap left by an overstrapped healthcare system in the Chinese mainland, where just a few hundred clinics performed 500,000 IVF treatment cycles in 2013. That is compared to 200,000 IVF cycles performed in the United States during the same year. Sue Channon is Group CEO of Virtus Health, headquartered in Sydney, Australia.
Look, there's certainly been an increase in inquiries from Chinese consumers and also medical providers looking to partner with our Australian fertility clinics. We have a very strong reputation in Australia for delivering very high quality and safe fertility services. And many of our doctors and staff in Australia speak Mandarin.
The horrors of China's one-child policy, such as forced abortions and sterilizations, may be soon replaced by a boom in the fertility industry, with foreign companies standing to benefit from the increased demand. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
For many people, the holidays are a time of stress, whether it's caused by the anxiety of making a big meal for friends and family or spending time with grumpy relatives. Most of the time, the stress holds no long-lasting effect. But if it becomes frequent and common over time, researchers say it could increase the risk of Alzheimer's. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Everyone experiences stress from time to time. It could be prompted by the death of a spouse or loss of a job. But psychiatrist Richard Lipton says it could also be something much less traumatic, like getting a traffic ticket.
One person gets a speeding ticket and they think, this is horrible, my insurance premiums are going to go up, I'm going to get a $100 fine, this is a disaster for me. And another person thinks, I shouldn't have been speeding, I'm going to be more careful in the future.
While a great loss can be devastating and the effects long-lasting, it's the person who perceives common situations as stressful, like the first driver Lipton described, who could be putting his or her psychological health at risk. Lipton, who is with the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York, explains that stressing out over the small hassles of everyday life can lead to mild cognitive impairment, which is a risk factor for a far more serious disorder.
People who have amnestic mild cognitive impairment go on to develop diagnosable Alzheimer's dementia at the rate of about 10 to 15% per year. So amnestic mild cognitive impairment is essentially most often an early form of Alzheimer's disease before dementia develops.
In a study reported in the journal Alzheimer's Disease and Associated Disorders, Lipton and colleagues administered a stress assessment test to just over 500 individuals ages 70 and older. The test rated their level of perceived stress. None of the participants had signs of mild cognitive impairment or dementia at the start of the study, called the Einstein Aging Study. They were followed for an average of 3.5 years with a battery of neuropsychological tests and given physical exams. During the study, 71 participants were diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. Those with the highest stress levels were 2.5 times more likely to develop the pre-Alzheimer's condition. Most were women with less education and higher levels of depression. Lipton says chronic stress has a number of negative effects on the body.
When stressful events happen and people perceive them to be stressful, there's a whole series of physiologic changes that take place. Blood pressure goes up, pulse goes up. The stress hormone cortisol is secreted. And over time, chronic stress can produce wear and tear on the body and wear and tear on the brain and lead to long-term health consequences.
Lipton says that lowering levels of perceived stress by engaging in activities such as yoga and meditation, for example, could help reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, where you can get the answers for just about anything. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called SwiftKey Symbols. It's an Android app with a picture-based keyboard that makes it easier for kids with autism to express themselves. The app lets users construct sentences by picking an image from several categories, such as people, actions, and colors, then predicts and suggests other words to continue the sentence.
Want Friday, tomorrow, Saturday, toy car.
So you want to play with your toy car.
This new technology is being used at Riverside School in London, where nearly two-thirds of the 220 pupils have autism. Charlotte Parkhouse is the school's language therapist.
To see our pupils use this app and suddenly they discover the joy of interaction between themselves, between themselves and adults, is really wonderful.
The SwiftKey company in London has not announced a launch date for this app, which they say is still in the very early stages of testing. VOA's What's New. I'm Todd Grossons.
This is VOA's International Edition. If you're one of those people who likes to look up facts or statistics, there's another way to find the answers besides just typing in the question on the Internet. You can try the 2016 World Almanac and Book of Facts. That's right, a book. The kind with a front cover, a back cover, and pages inside. Senior editor Sarah Jansen spoke with International Edition Susan Yockey about the latest version of this well-known reference work for just about anything.
The World Almanac has been around since 1868, so we've actually changed a lot over the course of our nearly 150-year history. But basically what we're about these days is providing your best go-to reference source for any question you might have, whether it's on politics or pop culture or science or sports, we've got you covered.
It's a reference book, basically.
Basically.
What are some of the major events of 2015?
Well, I think it would be no surprise to find out that our top news topic in 2015 was the ongoing civil war and conflict with ISIS in Iraq and Syria, obviously something that's going to be spilling into 2016. And then that's related to our number two top news topic, which was the refugee crisis. Almost a million refugees and migrants have reached Europe by boat or by sea in 2015, which is an enormous number. And that's, again, going to be something that we're going to be looking at in 2016 as well.
What about from the world of entertainment?
A lot happened in entertainment this year. Obviously, you saw the Star Wars premiere. That'll be interesting to see how that does numbers-wise as it tries to take down Avatar as the number one top-grossing film of all time. Adele's first record in a long time came out. You also saw the transition in Late Night with Stephen Colbert taking over for David Letterman. So a lot happened in 2015, for sure.
And what about sports?
Oh, gosh, it was a busy year in sports, too. I think one of the highlights for us was watching the U.S. women's national team take the World Cup this summer, the highest-rated World Cup of all time, which was really fun. You also saw the first Triple Crown winner in almost 40 years, an American Pharoah. You had Deflategate distracting everyone all year, Serena Williams trying to do that calendar Grand Slam. A lot of interesting events in sports this year.
And you haven't mentioned politics.
Well, we were paying attention to politics all year. Maybe everyone's a little bit tired of hearing about it, but we do have a really great election preview that includes things like primary dates, debate dates, also an overview of what's going on in the election, including financial information about all those many, many, many different campaigns, including information on how the super PACs are doing, since that's how a lot of campaigns are being funded these days.
Now, you have things organized a little differently this year. Please tell us when we go out and buy one of your almanacs, how do we go about researching it?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking to answer a specific question, it's the same as any other reference book. You can use the table of contents or the index. But I think a lot of people like to just flip through it and land on a page. And really, if you're a generally curious person, you might just find something that you would have no interest in necessarily looking up yourself, but you kind of you get hooked by the new information, by the fun that's available in the World Almanac.
World Almanac and Book of Facts senior editor Sarah Jansen speaking with International Edition Susan Yockey. Academy Award and Golden Globe winner Jennifer Lawrence stars in a new movie as a woman who makes her fortune by designing household products. Lawrence teams up with actor Bradley Cooper and director David O. Russell in the film called Joy. International Edition's David Byrd takes a look and listen.
Christy, look at me. I want you to remember something, because a lot of times people get nice things and they start to think differently.
We got here from hard work, patience, and humility.
So I want to tell you, don't ever think that the world owes you anything, because it doesn't. The world doesn't owe you a thing.
Jennifer Lawrence reunited with director David O. Russell and Bradley Cooper, her co-star in Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle, to tell the story of Joy Mangano, a Long Island-born housewife who found fame and fortune by designing household products. Mangano, a divorced mother of three, developed the so-called Miracle Mop, and in 1992 pitched it to the QVC television shopping network. It became an overnight success.
Hi, I'm Joy Mangano, and I invented the Miracle Mop. It's the original cotton self-wringing mop, therefore the most absorbent. It will clean that mess again and again and again. And
I'm Jennifer Lawrence says that she was inspired by Mangano's story and wanted to bring it to the screen.
There's so many impressive parts of her that she, and just about the story in general, about how kind of long it took her to finally decide, I'm not going to let this dream go. I'm going to keep fighting for this, no matter who believes in me, no matter who doesn't, no matter how many people say no.
You got the exact same outfit you had when you came in here.
I wear a blouse and I wear pants. That's who I am. I want to go on as me.
I want to go on as you. I hope you make it back. Joan, Cindy, say good luck to Joy.
Wow.
You look great. Good luck today.
Oh, thank
good
you.
Luck.
That's her. That's how she is.
Blossom, she should be in a skirt. She's got nice long legs. Show her legs. Good luck.
Joan Rivers wants me in a skirt, but I'm going to do pants.
Bradley Cooper says he actually met Joy Mangano, and he knew he wanted to make this film.
I was in the middle of doing a play, so then I knew that the real Joy was at the hotel I was staying at, so I went down and met her. So that's all I knew was based on a real thing. But I also was very aware of the Miracle Mop. I grew up using that mop because QVC was also a huge part of my upbringing.
Director David O. Russell, an Oscar nominee for his last two films with Lawrence and Cooper, says familiarity with his actors makes for a comfortable set where more chances are taken.
You have a comfort level with each other that just means you can take new chances. Jennifer is more quietly powerful in this film than I've seen her. She's not loud. She's doing something different that I find very interesting. Bradley as well. You know, they both watched them grow up in the last 5 years.
Jennifer Lawrence, who has been nominated for a Golden Globe for her performance in Joy, says that Russell makes it easy to take chances in front of the camera.
And it's so wonderful working with David, where I don't have to think about anything. If he gives me a note and it sounds absolutely insane, I just do it. It's a trust fall, and it's wonderful.
Joy also stars Oscar winner Robert De Niro as Joy Mangano's father, Rudy. Melissa Rivers stars as her mother, comedian and QVC host Joan Rivers, and actors Donna Mills and Susan Lucci portray themselves. The film opens December 25th in the United States. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Even as the world marks the 67th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, China continues to crack down on rights defenders and others who seek to peacefully question official policy and contribute to the public discourse on China's future. Since July, the Chinese government has detained nearly 300 lawyers and activists. The United States has called for the release of more than 20 such people who remain in custody, as well as Ilham Tati, Ken Pokartsi, Zhong Kai, Gao Yu, and Liu Xiaobo. Rights lawyer Pu Jicheng, who was arrested following his participation in a private meeting to peacefully mark the 25th anniversary of the violent suppression of the Tiananmen Square protests, is currently on trial. He stands accused of making criminal comments online, inciting ethnic hatred, and picking quarrels and provoking troubles. Pu Jicheng has been detained since May 2014. The United States mission to the United Nations recently expressed concern with China's national security law, noting that it codifies an expansive and vague definition of national security that invites arbitrary and situational interpretation by security forces. In addition, the United States is also concerned that the government's draft foreign non-governmental management law would unreasonably constrict civil society and undermine people-to-people exchange. It is incumbent on China to uphold the rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Marking the 67th anniversary of this important document on December 10th, President Barack Obama said, "We will continue to lift up the lives of all who yearn to exercise their inherent human rights and to shine a light on those still living in the darkest pockets of our world."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.